radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Good morning and welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. And this month we are very honored to have with us as our guest Captain Tom Parks, who is in charge of the Motor Maintenance Division of the Cherry Hill, New Jersey Fire Department. And by way of introduction, before we get to throwing some questions at Captain Parks, Captain Parks has 36 years of service with fire departments, starting in with the Earlton Fire Company, one of the now defunct all-volunteer companies in Cherry Hill Township in 1974. In 1980, Captain Parks became elected a commissioner in Earlton and was placed in charge of apparatus acquisitions and equipment and maintenance. Just 1 year later, he was appointed as a career firefighter and in Cherry Hill. And in 1994, when all of the different smaller volunteer departments became consolidated and organized under the Cherry Hill Department, since that time, for the last 16 years, Captain Parks has been in charge of their motor maintenance division. And right after the break, we'll get into a little more discussion about some of the things that Captain Parks does. But most interesting to me during my last visit with Captain Parks and his facility, they had a little slogan up on the wall that we'll just throw as a teaser. We'll let you know what that slogan is right after the break. But I know, Brother Mike, you know, there's a lot of people that like to put slogans on their apparatus, you know, like over the windshield, like, you know, go home, we got it. Or I know if I got to, I'm going to throw you the softball here, Mike. You know, if you're on the ladder company, you got the big mural on the side that says, you know, cancel the engine, and it shows some lusty-looking truckie going in to the fire with a can and a hook. And I just keep remembering, you know, Andy Frederick said, you know, he's been to a lot of fires, but he never saw a fire go out with an axe yet. But, Mike, I guess maybe your career would show us differently. But at any rate, Captain Parks' Motor Maintenance Division, they've got a pretty neat little slogan that's posted up on the wall, and we'll get into that right after the break. So welcome to Captain Parks. And, again, we're very very happy and pleased to have you as our guest for today. So maybe just to give our listeners, Captain Parks, a little bit of introduction into the what you handle in Cherry Hill with the size of your fleet in terms of the major pieces of apparatus and support vehicles and everything. What's how much rolling stock do you have to contend with down there in your department?
Well, you know, first of all, fellas, I'm really pleased to be with you this morning. As a matter of fact, I've actually been looking forward to it ever since I met with you, Tom, 3 weeks ago or so. And I think the idea is, and what I like to do is, you know, get the information out there, you know, because if one piece of it is helpful to everybody, you know, in this business, it's well worth it. First of all, I guess as far as our rolling stock is concerned, we have approximately 50 units, and these units vary. We have four first-line engines, and they're complemented by two reserve pieces. So, you know, needless to say, you know, having two reserve engines for four front-line is pretty good. We also have two full-service ladders, one aerial scope and a rear-mount 100-foot ladder, and one reserve piece also. So, you know, I have, you know, two engine reserves, one ladder reserve. We do have a heavy rescue. We do have a foam unit that carries 1,500 gallons of universal and full pump capability. We also do collapse rescue in confined space. We have a unit that does that. Hazardous material is a big thing, and one of the companies one of the active companies that does that also has a hazmat vehicle that, you know, carries everything that you would normally carry on that for. And they do spend quite a bit of time in training, believe it or not, with the hazmat. There's always something new coming out, that's for sure.
So can Captain Clarkson, with your four engines and your two ladder companies, for our listeners, those units are fully staffed with career personnel all the time, correct?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
Okay. And then the is the rescue unit staffed full-time, or is that cross-staffed with people from one of the other companies?
Yeah, that would be cross-staffed with one of the other engine companies. Depending on the particular call, if the rescue needed to, go out as a, there's one rescue in town, but if it needed to go and assist another engine company or a ladder company, it could very easily do that. One thing I should note on that is that all of the companies first line companies, the two ladders and the four engines, they all carry rescue tools. And if it gets anything above, a basic door popper or whatever you would call it, we would get into the heavy rescue responding with
airbags. I'm sorry to interrupt,
but
someone is breathing on their line. It's coming through very, very heavy, wind-like static on the phone. I'm sorry to interrupt,
okay.
But I don't want to mess up the recording.
Yeah, okay. I'm inside my house, so I know it's not coming from me.
Okay, and I'm in the office.
It's definitely breathing. Just try to be careful that you're not breathing into your microphone.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Okay. What do you want us to, Patrick? What do you want us to pick up from then?
Whoever was speaking, you can just start their sentence right from the top. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
I guess that's me, right, Tom?
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Basically, all the engine and ladder companies, they all have rescue tools on them, and we use the heavy rescue to supplement them. In the event that, the call they're on is a little more complicated than, door removal or what have you.
Captain Parks, when I was there years ago, you were actually cross-staffing the trucks. What year did that change?
The truck companies, if we went into each particular firehouse and you would see more than one piece there, the engine, as a matter of fact, where do I park the reserve engines when the reserve engines are not being utilized? One of them may be in with one of the active trucks, and that doesn't mean that somebody crosses the floor to get on them. It's just a place where, we just have to store the engine until it's needed, or even the reserve ladder. I'm going to take a guess and say maybe about 5 years ago, where the ladder companies, this was their function, this is what they run first out, and, they're not crossing the floor. There's one ladder company on the east side of town and one on the west.
Thank you.
All right, Captain Parkson, with the size of your fleet there, 50 units there between your frontline rigs, your reserve units, and then all your support stuff, give us a little background as to what your shop facilities look like and what kind of either, particular equipment that you might have, or where you make the decision line as to something that you're going to fix in-house versus something that you're going to either have an existing contract or have to call a vendor and say, hey, listen, we need to make an appointment and run this over. Because I'm gathering it with the size and complexity of your fleet there that sometimes it's kind of difficult to figure out what you could pretty easily get overwhelmed with the amount of issues or problems that you have to face in any 8 or 10-hour daytime period.
Definitely. Well, we have about 3,600 square feet of workspace for our shop. And it's a standalone shop, and that includes, parts and, tire storage and fabrication. We do some fabrication. We also have the capacity to lift over 90,000 pounds. Getting something, especially an aerial device up over your head and walking under it, for some of the new people to get in the fire department, it's something to get used to, but it makes it so much easier for service and discovery of problems and things. But we have to sometimes prioritize things. Like, you know, most departments that have maybe a group of mechanics or maybe one mechanic, you know, sometimes or more times than not, they have to prioritize their work. On occasion, we can get swamped. And the thing is, what do I work on first, you know? And the thing is, we prioritize the vehicle, which, you know, basically means that some of the staff vehicles and some of the vehicles that have secondary positions, if we're not going to be able to do anything with them to repair them in a certain period of time, we will send them to another vendor. And I'm really talking mostly light-duty vehicles like Ford Explorers and cars, things like that.
But including yourself and Captain, how many full-time mechanics do you have in the shop to service your fleet?
Well, we have two full-time mechanics and one part-time. And I'd just like to say the one part-time fellow who was at one time a full-time mechanic, I don't know if you met him when you were by our shop, Emil Pfluger, Jr., he's been with us for quite a number of years. Matter of fact, he was the first actual firefighter slash mechanic that had ever had that title in this town. And he's at the ripe old age of 80 and still going strong. And
wow.
Yes. And I'll tell you what, he has forgotten more than we'll ever know. He's just that kind of guy. And I'll tell you, you know, the type of work that he does, it's phenomenal. I mean, the fabrication work and, and he still wants to do it, and he's, you know, he can do it for as long as he's around, he can do it. And I'll tell you what, he's an asset.
Well, that's pretty incredible to have.
I mean, altogether, I mean, with all four of us there, we probably have over 150 years of experience. So, a lot of the new fellas that come into the department, you know, they'll see, Emil in the shop, and they would nicely say, you know, how you doing? How are you? Introduce themselves, this and that. And then I would take them aside, and I said, you know, he used to work on the horse-drawn apparatus when we had
it. Well, knowing a little bit, Captain, about your fleet and what brands that you have operating, certainly I think lends itself to some challenges. But in particular, with some of the you know, we call it newer technology, although it's been around for a while, and I guess specifically things like multiplexing, which I know you have on your fleet of your medic units. How, given the size, the very modest size of the number of mechanics you have in yourself, what any particular tricks of the trade or things that you've done that have worked for you and the fellas to keep you up on the different, particularly the electronic technology with the newer apparatus and the units that you're running?
Well, every time an apparatus comes out, there's always something new on it electronically, and of course, multiplexing, it's commonplace on a lot of apparatus now, and perhaps that's the biggest change, because everything else, you know, mechanically, even though you have, you know, computers and things like that, the mechanics and the things really have stayed pretty much the same, but when it comes to electronics or things that are new to us, that's when we start digging into, exactly what makes it tick, sort of. And what we do is, as an example, I'll send the guys out on training just for that. They'll go to the factory, and they will take a multiplex class. Now, again, you know, with all their work over the years and with all their experience, I'm not going to send them out there, and they're not going to be, you know, working on a rear axle. But on things that like such as Moldiplex, you know, and the electronics, I'm concentrating mostly on that. And we will contact the factory, and even if the factory, or if it was a component that they didn't even have information, I mean, other than sales information, we would go to the manufacturer themselves, a component manufacturer, and ask them about the inward operation of it, and then even ask them that we're looking for information or even to come down and give us a class in our own shop.
What is your fleet made up with for our listeners that may not be familiar with the different manufacturers that you have in your fleet, Captain?
Well, as far as the majority of the fleet, it's probably 50-50 Seagrave and Pierce. The newer units that we had recently purchased, they were 2008. They are Pierces. And again, at one time the fleet was 100%, just about 100% Seagrave. On some of the light duty or some of the utility units, hazmat and things like that, you might see an international standard chassis or a collapse unit. But it's safe to say the major heavy apparatus is Pierce and Seagrave.
Captain, with the preventative maintenance program that you've overseen for the years that you've been in motor maintenance there, what type of parameters or what basis do you use to take your four pumpers? How often, if I'm a career firefighter and I'm just riding in the jump seat or the bucket, how often during the course of a year would I not be riding in my frontline unit because you've got it down on your shop to do a routine PM? And is there any particular – what criteria do you use? Do you use time or mileage or operating hours? Or how, what has worked for you in Cherry Hill? Again, it's good for the listeners. It's a department that's pretty active. We're not talking about people that sit around for days on end and waiting for the next run. You've got a department that's running, you know, a lot of annual calls. So what – on what basis have you made the determination for what a regular PM of when you're going to do it and what kind of things are you looking for when you bring a rig in?
I guess to start off, each unit annually probably runs between 1,200 and 1,300 runs a year. But as far as maintenance is concerned, we go through a ignition time sequence on the heavy units, such as 200 hours of operating time. And that usually takes us to about 2.5 to 3 months to get the vehicle in. So, you know, as you saying, riding in the bucket, you know, basically you would probably, you know, be without your apparatus maybe four times a year. So, you know, the 200 hours has treated us very well. Matter of fact, we were able to find things that, you know, if it had gone to maybe 300 or 400 hours, may have caused a problem. On the other lighter duty vehicles, on ambulances and things like that, we usually they're mileage based, approximately 5,000 miles. Between the preventive maintenance intervals.
So with that being said, then even the modest size of your engine and ladder fleet, and with your reserves, and this is one of the things that Mike and I have talked about. Departments sometimes look at their reserve units as kind of like a plus, saying, "Well, I have a house, and geez, I also had I got a patio that if it gets too hot, I can step outside." But in your case, these reserve units, given the frequency of your PMs. On any given day, it's reasonable to expect that you're going to have one of your frontline engines and ladders in the shop for a PM, and those reserve units are actually serving in a frontline capacity.
Yes, and I could probably count the number of days on one hand in a year that that wasn't so. I mean, the reserve units are out on the street normally because there is always something in the shop, and not because of breakdown or failure, just because of maintenance. So the reserve fleet, you know, gets used quite a bit. And, you know, again, that's like what I said, we don't have to look for the work. The preventative maintenance end of taking care of the apparatus alone keeps us on our toes.
But Captain Parks, you mentioned some things or components or things that you caught at the 200-hour interval that may have caused an issue if you let it go a little longer. Could you just, you know, give us any insight as to, you know, one or two specific cases of something that you could reference in that for a component for something that was really important to look at that point in time?
Sure. I'll give you a couple examples. On one occasion, one of the mechanics was, you know, under the rig, or I should say it was up on the lift, and he noticed between the dual tires on one of the engines, something must have gotten caught actually between the tires at one time and cut into the sidewall, into the steel cord. And, you know, normally, you know, in between the tires, you know, I mean, you know, the fellows on the front line, they do apparatus checks, but to get down in between the dualies and find something like that would be really hard to come by.
Right.
We've also found a broken spring, a leaf spring, one leaf spring in the pack on the rear axle of one of the units was broken completely through. And, you know, the vehicle wasn't in an accident or anything. It was, you know, purely a fatigue. And again, you know, depending on where it's broken in the pack could have a lot to do with whether the rear axle stays tried and true in the truck in the vehicle. So, we have found things like that, and that's why that, you know, hey, I would like to have these vehicles in maybe at 150 hours, but see, you really don't know. But the 200 hour has really served us really well, and we have no thoughts of abandoning it. It really is really the way to go, you know, as far as our minimum standard. Now, you know, different companies have different needs, and if the apparatus is, you know, out 20 times a day, well, that's different. Or if it rolls out of the fire station once a month, you know, that could be different. But we did experiment with it right from the onset to find this comfort area for our application.
It's two quick comments, Captain Parks. One is interesting, the fact that you have the ability to put apparatus up on the lifts to have caught, in particular, as you mentioned, the damage inside the sidewall on that tire, that if the apparatus is sitting on the ground, it's going to be kind of difficult to obviously do any kind of, you know, quality visual inspection on it in that particular area. And it goes to a point when Michael and I have gone out to do some fleet evaluations and have asked people, as we're starting to get into the first piece of apparatus, Brother Michael asks people, do you have a creeper? And they'll kind of look around like, well, we don't keep the creeper on a fire truck. Well, do you have a creeper in the station? And it's amazing to me the number of times that people don't even have something as simple as that, which if they're responsible for doing any type of just basic, whether it's weekly or monthly visual inspections, if they don't have a creeper, chances are they're not getting underneath the rig to go look at anything, and then basically then relying upon the grace of God that if it breaks, hopefully it's not going to break when they're in an emergency response mode. So,
well, you know, what we noticed that what the lift actually does is, you know, when you're, if you have a creeper and if you're laying on your back and I don't know what it is, but you see things a lot clearer when you're standing on your feet rather than when you're laying on your back. And we're able to look at every component without, you know, having any problems at all, you know, moving around the base of it or seeing from one side to the other. I mean, part of our, you know, preventive maintenance activity, and it does take some time, is this discovery. We go through this discovery from bumper to tailboard and actually look for things that are questionable. There are so many components, as you know, on these things, and that, you know, you see an apparatus, you know, going down the road, and naturally everyone may think, oh, it's fine. There's no problem with it. Everything is 100%. Well, you know what? I mean, that's not too often the case. You know, you can have, you know, problems that are just waiting for a place to happen, you know, but getting the visual view of it, I think this is probably one of our best investments that we ever made because it just you have such a clearer view and you can throw all kinds of light underneath this thing. And it just, you know, other than doing the repair work, it makes it so much easier. But the discovery thing is very important. And we use the lift exclusively.
And that's a very, very valid comment, Captain Parks. I just, because on a normal engine, on a pump, one of your pumpers in your fleet.
There's no such a thing. Brother Tom, there's no such a thing as a normal engine.
After that left my lips, I thought to myself, I'm going to be sorry I said that. But don't worry. There's a second half of the show, and that's when you get equal time for the other party. How many man hours does it take you to do a PM on a vehicle? Again, sometimes departments think a preventative maintenance program is you change lube oil and filter, and you know you're back out on the street. And to go to your point, as you mentioned, you know, because you didn't have a component failure or you made the run and you went out and you responded and you got back to the station and the rig's still running, everybody thinks, you know, life is grand, that there's no problems. So how long is the rig in your shop when you're doing one of your PMs?
Well, and I did mention again about the discovery process. And when the rig comes into our shop, once we get our hands on it, you could say it's there for the duration. In other words, no one's going to be knocking on the door, at least except for the chief's office, maybe. when's the apparatus going to be, or how much time do you anticipate? But if the vehicle comes into the shop and does not need repairs and just needs preventative maintenance, now, this doesn't happen very often where it comes in the shop and, oh, we're going to do fluid changes, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and then it's back out on the street. That really never happens. There's always something that we discover or something that, oh, listen, could you guys put another shelf in the rear compartment or could you put a place where I could, stash this or stash that? And if a vehicle comes in and just needs pure preventative maintenance, I'll have it for 16 hours. I need 16 man hours to do preventative maintenance on an engine. Now, we don't run a fast lube kind of a shop. We found that, you know, if we don't give the quality up front of examining these vehicles, it's going to come back. Be it a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And then it throws the proverbial wrench into the works.
Right.
So what, you know, we try to do is let's look for the weak link. Let's take our time. Let's be thorough. Look, we're all human, and you know, you can miss things. But what we try and do is we try and narrow that gap so that we don't miss things. And again, it's about 16 man hours that would take us to do a preventative maintenance on an engine.
Well, just before the break, there was one other topic that we wanted to hit, but again, for the listeners, and again, I think this is a really important point, is that in your jurisdiction, Captain, the quality of your reserve or spare apparatus is probably second to none. So for our listeners, what years are your two spare engines in the truck?
The two spare engines are 1997 Seagraves, and the reserve ladder is a 2002 Pierce, 100-foot rear mount.
Yeah, so you have relatively new units that are in very good shape and condition, and they're not running around, you know, with rigs that, you know, look legitimately, you know, probably should have left the fleet. And that's, again, what Mike and I find with an awful lot of communities, is that they treat the reserve or spare apparatus as something as like an outside luxury rather than a necessity in order to embark on a program such as yours, so that you can take care of the rigs and know that they're going to operate the way they need to, as well as operate in a safe manner.
Exactly. And you know, all too often, the reserve apparatus is looked to as secondary, and we don't do that at all, because, again, that reserve apparatus has to perform exactly the same as that front line. Aside from, you know, different type of equipment carrying or whatever, but it has to perform, whether it is brand new out of the box, or if it has 100,000 miles of, fire apparatus operation on it. So
right.
There is no difference. We know that reserve, it's a little older, yes. But the upkeep of it is second to none.
Very, very, very good topic. The next one we want to just get into before we take a quick break for listeners, what kind of experience, Captain, have you had with auxiliary braking devices?
Well, I guess we've at one time or another we've had them.
Hello?
Had them all. The engine brakes. The engine brakes were the mainstay for years, and most apparatus had them. And of course, years ago they were an option.
Okay. All right.
And now the engine brakes are secondary braking devices.
Gentlemen, sorry to interrupt, but can we do that question from the top? Whoever's phone call in the background is pretty much covered.
Yeah, okay. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Just, when my cell phone was ringing with another call, and I apologize. That was the house line. Mike somehow lost all of his phone service, and he's trying to call back in but getting a busy signal. So we'll pick it up from that point, but it'll just be me and you, Tom, and Patrick for the rest of the duration here.
Okay.
Okay. So, all right. I'll phrase the question again for you. So, all right. Captain Parks, I know you've had a lot of experience with auxiliary braking devices on your units, and impact that's had on some of the mileage intervals in between major brake jobs. What can you share with us in that area?
Well, we've had all the, I guess, the major devices on our apparatus from the past through today. We started with engine brakes years ago, and that was basically the only thing around. For the most part, and they were options. You could buy apparatus, and you didn't even need a secondary braking device. Well, of course, times have changed, and NFPA and this and that, and the apparatus, they do need a secondary braking device, which is the greatest thing going. We still have transmission retarders, and when we went from engine brakes to transmission retarders, we noticed that the foundation brakes on the apparatus, it almost completely stopped the wear. One engine in particular that runs approximately 12,000 miles per year, we found that the foundation brakes lasted almost 7 years. And for a flatline apparatus, that's pretty impressive. Of course, when we did this, when we spec'd the vehicle out, we put all the money into the secondary braking device, and put the standard drums, drum brake system with high friction shoes on the apparatus. So what we were doing, we were saving the brakes for the time that when they were really needed. You could basically drive this engine throughout the town in a non-emergency mode and not touch the brake pedal once except to come to a complete stop.
Did you have any issues with the transmission retarder, Captain, with any overheating issues on the vehicle?
Yes. Yes, we did. And here's the thing with the transmission retarders. You know, when you start out at a fire station, when you go to a call, and naturally you're trying to get there as quick as you can, and you're using the retarder, you know, you're taking the heat out of the brake system, but you're putting it in the transmission fluid. And what we were finding was that on back-to-back calls, or calls that took the apparatus across town, and just to let you know, Cherry Hill's about 25 square miles, we were noticing that the transmission retarders would not have as much force, would not have as much braking power after you had maybe the second call. And again, we're watching the temperature gauge on the fluid, and the fluid is getting higher and higher and higher, which it is going to. And naturally, that heat has to be transferred to the antifreeze. And if the temperature continues to exceed, the transmission will automatically back off on the amount of the transmission operation or the retarder portion. It will back off a percentage to save itself to keep the temperature control. Right out of the box, they worked great, but it wasn't the type of thing that you could be driving around all day and expect it to be at 100%, if you follow what I'm saying.
Okay, so as a result of that, did you have to do anything to either to change the cooling package or to look at going to a different type of fluid in the transmission at all, Captain?
Yes. As a matter of fact, synthetic fluid for a transmission with a retarder, I would say, is a must. The synthetic fluid can take the heat, you know, as opposed to the standard fluid. And matter of fact, it has better cooling properties too, to even get to remove the heat from the oil. So we changed to synthetic, and on three pieces of apparatus, we also increased the heat exchanger size because we felt as though the heat exchangers that were installed at the apparatus factory were not sized according to our usage. And that was the thing when we first got into the transmission retarders. I think the transmission manufacturers, you know, they put out a bulletin. If you're going to have a retarder, you need to have X amount of BTUs of heat removal, et cetera. So what we did was we increased the bundle, the tube bundle, I guess you could say, which is a heat exchanger, and we got better performance out of the transmission retarder. And of course, you know, that's not the end of it. Actually, the end of it is on the last group of apparatus. We went to magnetic field retarders, and again, you know, secondary braking device, excellent choice, and it's air cooled. So our thoughts were that watching the apparatus manufacturers and all the emission control equipment and how they were coping or trying to cope with higher engine temperatures, we looked at the transmission retarder cooler as taking the apparatus cooling system to the extreme, if you follow what I'm saying.
Okay.
And we thought that, you know, other than changing the cab of the apparatus, I mean, the manufacturers, they have a radiator in there that's so big, and they really can't make it any larger than it is, you know, unless they do some type of auxiliary or a secondary radiator somewhere. But you sure couldn't fit it under the hood, let's say. And we're trying to be proactive with this, and we're saying, well, the transmission retarders work very well, but the magnetic field, or a name brand, a Telma retarder, works just as well. And it's air-cooled. Of course, it uses high amperage of 12-volt electricity, but it does not tax the cooling system of the diesel. And
with the Telma retarders, then, Captain, what's your standard, like on your four newest Pierce units that you took delivery of, what's your standard battery pack and alternator system that you use to support that?
Well, you know, it's, you know, I seem to recall, and just go back in history, years ago, you know, there was always a problem with, you know, you couldn't do a retarder like that and a Q2B siren at the same time or simultaneously, which is not true now. Years ago it was, but what we use for a battery pack, we use six Group 31 batteries. You know, the old style was those two big 8D batteries that, you know, weighed about 150 pounds each on each side of the cab. I think you remember that, right?
Yeah.
But you can get so much more amperage and storage capability out of a group of half a dozen Group 31s. And, you know, we also, when we do the amperage calculations on these things, and again, we don't just leave it up to the manufacturer. You know, now with the onset of LED lights and you know, things like that are not high amperage devices. You know, we're able to save that amperage for something else, such as the retarder, the electronic retarder. And we found out that our standard alternator right now is a 320-amp alternator. And that does more. It's more than sufficient to operate all the lighting on the warning lighting on the apparatus, and a Q2B siren, a mechanical Q2B siren, and a transmission, or I should say, a mechanical or magnetic field retarder. So,
do you have computers on board the rigs, Captain?
Excuse me?
You have computers on board the apparatus as well?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Matter of fact, the laptops. They get all their information from the dispatch center through them. Matter of fact, we just got into that, I guess, over the past, I'm going to say the past year, where the dispatch center, you know, sends all the information that they have to us, and then we send it back, et cetera. I want to stress that the biggest thing with having the system that we did is, you know, when our apparatus is in station, you know, it has what we call parasitic loads on it, and that is hand lights and portable radios and thermal imaging camera and computer is always on. And that parasitic load, it's important to manage that. And while I say by managing, all the vehicles have onboard chargers. And when that vehicle, no matter whether it's an ambulance or a fire apparatus, when that leaves the station, those batteries are at 100%. So if we were not to have that, and, you know, we went out and we came back and we went out and we came back and this and that, all of a sudden, you know, the battery voltage is now, or the battery capacity is at 75, 65%, whatever. And then it's going to begin to affect certain things. It's going to make the alternator try to run at capacity. It's going to, you know, cause other problems. And we haven't had one single electrical charging problem to think of. And again, if you start with a good foundation, if you start with the batteries at 100% and you monitor and you take care of your parasitic loads so they're not taking energy out of your battery, if you start off with 100%, we don't notice any problems whatsoever. So the crew goes on their emergency, they come back, they plug the vehicle in, and everything's good to go.
Very good. Well, Captain, with that, we'll take a short break. This is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shaney, Apparatus Architects, today with Captain Tom Parks from the Cherry Hill, New Jersey Fire Department. Captain Parks is in charge of their fleet through the Motor Maintenance Division. And with that, we'll be back in a few minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, we're back. Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, today with Captain Tom Parks from the Cherry Hill, New Jersey Fire Department. And, Captain, I know when I last visit to your office there, I wheeled in and was kind of amazed by looking at that large, almost blueprint-sized spreadsheet that you had on the wall that had all of your units in the fleet and when they were next scheduled to come in for PM work and stuff like that. And across the banner on the top of that, you had a particular slogan which said what?
Well, first of all, I have to say that this slogan I borrowed from our brothers in California that work on apparatus. And it basically says, without us, they walk. And, you know, everyone that stops in and sees that, you know, and especially, you know, the guys in the shop, and I says, you know, it is so true that, you know, the people in maintenance, I mean, you know, a lot of what we do is, I mean, if you look at it even in a military standpoint or a paramilitary situation, you know, you have an armored personnel carrier or a tank or anything that has to go do the job. It has to be able to perform, or else people's lives are on the line. And, you know, it's just as important for fire apparatus. You go into an emergency, you're not using a truck to pick up peaches. You know? So it's a kind of thing that we hold close to our hearts. And you know, it is a little humorous, but you know what? We're a necessary item in the fire department, and and the guys know it.
But you know, Captain, how it struck me is that in some of the conversations that Brother Mike and I have gotten in with people when we go out to instruct at a conference or when we're out at Firehouse World in San Diego, whether it's the Expo in Baltimore, whatever, and people would come up and literally tell us some horror stories over what's going on in their community with respect to apparatus, and beyond just apparatus, new rigs and replacement that we'll get into in a second, but what's happening with what they're running in their fleet, where because of the economic condition that their jurisdiction is in, basically, if it's not broke, don't call us, you know, just keep running it. And if we did have a reserve unit, as Mike's been told sometimes, well, you can come down and go into the reserve unit, but it really is a lot worse than what you're running given the condition, so just keep you know, doing it. And your observation of what you're doing in Cherry Hill with the excellent program that you have, not only for your fleet replacement, but what you're doing to keep that stuff safe and on the street and in a real high state of operational condition, I just got a great chuckle out of it, because it just, to me, kind of set the tone for the way you folks operate. So the fact you stole it from the brothers out on the West Coast, that's great. So moving in then to what we were just talking about with new apparatus, how much input do you have, or what is, you know, what's your level of involvement when your department is going to go purchase a new piece of apparatus over the course of the last 16 years? What's been your experience with that?
Well, you know, I hate to, I mean, a lot of times I'll say, you know, we're very fortunate, which we are, you know. We are able to do the specifications on the apparatus ourselves, and we have been ever since we consolidated. Matter of fact, even prior to the consolidation, I took care of it for one of the stations. And I should note that we also talk to our other brothers that surround us in the surrounding towns. To do an apparatus specification, first of all, you can't, do it part-time or do it on a Tuesday night if you have an hour or two. I'm doing this full-time, apparatus specifications, and there's no other way that I could do it to get it right or to get it as perfect as I could. Now, no apparatus is 100%. It can come right out of the factory, brand new, but guess what? There's going to be something wrong with it. That goes without saying. It's made by people. Things happen. But we take all the information from the fire department as far as what their needs are. For instance, how big is the hose bed? How much hose supply line do you need to carry? How many pre-connects? How many discharges? Are you going to run a rescue tool off of it? How about lighting? We take all this information and we build around it. So the fire department's needs will be met in this apparatus. And what we try and do, of course, we try and look out of the box and say, well, okay, here's our needs today. How long are we going to have these rigs? Well, we may have them for 15 years, 20 years. What are we going to need in the future? So we try to look into our crystal ball a little bit, say, well, what will the future bring? Well, really, who knows? But we just don't build it for today. So we take the fire department information through the chief's office and the battalion chiefs and all the way down to the engine company lieutenants and the captains, and we put all that information together. And the apparatus will be built around it. And when I say built around it is, you know, it needs to have so many gallon booster tank. It needs to have so much of a pump. It needs to be able to carry so much hose and equipment. And, oh, by the way, I need some lighting and I need et cetera. So we take all that together. And then myself, the mechanics, and one other fellow who had just retired, Bill Camps, we would work on, let's build around these things. And we would put the components in place. We would worry about how fast the apparatus accelerates, how quickly we can get it to stop, safety equipment. We have a safety division that is always proactive also. You know, we take their input, you know.
What about from the field, Captain?
Yes,
from field, from line guys and line officers.
Well, those, all that information, like I said, that's where it starts. The chief's office, notifies the officers. Okay, we will be speccing in the next few months a new engine, just as an example. What do you like and dislike about the engine that you have now? Is it meeting all the criteria for the job that you need to do, or where is it lacking, or where is it exceeding? In other words, it's open ended. We there are some things that work excellent that we have kept them. There are other things that work pretty good, but we could polish it a little bit better. We stick with things that work as best we can. And we just don't say, well, let's change the spec because this is different and this looks like it's really neat. if it doesn't work on the apparatus or if it has a problem, you know, we bury it. You know, if it's working for us, you'll see it on the new apparatus as long as the manufacturer is still building it or making it. You know what I mean?
But you mentioned earlier, Captain, that your four newest units, which I believe was the engine, the rear mount truck, and then the two engines that were equipped with squirts, they were all non-multiplex units, correct?
That's correct. Yes, they were. And, you know, we had that option, you know, in the beginning when we started putting the specs together, we weren't really interested in the multiplex units. I mean, we do have one in the fleet, and it's been fine. And, you know, like I said, the guys have had training on it. And but, you know, for our application, you know, we don't need the bells and whistles. You know, I need the thing to be dependable, and I need it to have longevity. I look at it as the multiplexing is great, and it does a lot of things for you. But if you can do without it, by all means, because there's only so many people that can work on them. And, you know, our apparatus that we purchase is standard rocker switches and relays and, you know, circuit breakers and things like that. It's very standard. I mean, you know, and we don't have any problems. But, you know, again, it is bare bones and it is very, very basic. I need the lights to work when somebody turns the switch on rather than turning the switch on and then the computer deciding whether the light should come on or not. I just think it's better just to turn the switch on and have the function happen because the operator called for it.
Well, with some of those thoughts in mind, Captain, and again, for our listeners, they need to understand that what Captain Parks is talking about is based on his experience, in as extensive as it is, and what works in Cherry Hill. There seems to be, and Mike and I have fielded some of these questions back and forth, but it's once again rising. People like to debate pro and con back and forth between the functional capability and the operational capabilities of a single stage versus a two stage pump. So to kind of set this up with the framework, what do you run, single stage or two stage pumps in Cherry Hill? And just brief explanation, what has your experience been with that, and why is it working for you?
Well, I mean, if we go back in time a little bit, we had mostly two-stage pumps. In the past 25, 30 years, we've gone to all single-stage pumps. And you know what the thing is the application and how you use the pump and what are you using it for versus, well, let's get a two-stage pump because it has an extra stage, you know. It works for us really well. I mean, you know, in some companies that are running higher pressures and things like that, again, it may be a necessary tool. In our mode, the single-stage pump does everything that we ask it for and more. So, really, not even saying about the complexity versus one versus the other, not even going there. It's the application. And, you don't get twice as much water out of a two-stage pump as you get, you know, because a lot of people maybe believe that or whatever. But in time of, higher pressures and things like that, it is a good tool to have. It is a good tool to have. But, again, you know, single-stage pump is very basic, has less moving parts in it. And again, our fleet is entirely, at this point, all single-stage.
And Captain, you've got all your custom chassis apparatus, obviously just running big block engines, either formerly Series 60 or the newer rigs that you had cats. And what GPM rating did you spec on your last batch of pumpers?
Actually, the GPM rating is 1,500 gallon per minute. And actually, it's the same model pump that we've been using since we since we consolidated the same model. So I have naturally a few parts on the shelf, but fit one, fit them all. And the other thing is the gallon per minute rating of the pump was really based upon what our requirements are for gallon per minute flow from ISO, as per ISO. So that 1500, is similar, I guess, set from ISO's requirements or our, let's just say, our gallon per minute flow requirements that are needed on first alarm assignments.
Okay. And again, for our listeners, the reason we ask is there are certain areas of the country that just seem to be enamored with buying the largest capacity pump that's physically made by the particular pump manufacturer that they're interested in. And while there isn't anything in and of itself wrong with that, it just does tend to add to the cost. And if you're typical, if you look and analyze the kind of fires you're doing in your community, you can always what-if a lot of things. You know, here the Cherry Hills has two of their engines are equipped with squirts, so certainly they can be supplying combination of a master stream, elevated master stream device together with multiple hand lines or portable deck guns, and can, with a strong water system, can easily do that with 1500 GPM pumps. There isn't a necessity that everything you buy has got to be 2000 or 2250, and when you ask the question why, you get a blank stare, and a lot of times it's because it's available, and that was our point. Mike, I know you had a question for the captain that you wanted to talk about something with components. Why don't you throw that at him?
Yeah, Captain Parks, day in and day out over the course of the last several years, what are some component failures that have been pretty standard across the board where you've had to, go out and make repairs on whether it be brakes or alternators or something of that nature? What are the top three or four or five things that you found problematic across the fleet?
Well, it does vary. We're proactive on some things that we can prevent. I'll give you an example. We were having some alternator problems with a bearing failure in the alternator. Nothing to do with the alternator's charging capability, but with a bearing, and so we found out that these particular alternators kind of have a weak link, and so we're proactive. So every maybe 3 or 4 years, we would pull the alternator and replace a particular bearing in the alternator before it has a problem. Because, again, if an alternator self-destructs, that's $3,000 on up. For parts that cost $100, we can, actually rebuild the alternator or replace the bearing that we felt just wasn't engineered properly. Now, other things that happen out in the field, a lot of things as far as components that have failed on us, with us, is, well, we've gotten into standard, the fire pumps. We use water as fire pumps, and of course we use a mechanical seal. And naturally, the mechanical seals work wonderful. They work great, but they're not forgiving when it comes to heat. So we've been proactive with our training division because, if the guys don't circulate water and they're at a standby, be it a motor vehicle accident or whatever, they don't circulate water, they're going to destroy that mechanical seal, and then the pump leaks, and then it has to come into the shop. So we've been very proactive in getting the word out that these large pumps are made for a large flow of water. They're not made to stand by and churn water and just keep churning water in its place and not moving it either back into the booster tank or out of nozzle. So, again, they're large gallon per minute pumps, and that's what they were designed for. They weren't designed to go into pump gear and sit at high RPMs all day. But component failures, on most of the engines that we've had, not the new ones, the older ones, we've had some spring issues where you would see a crack in a spring during the PM, and we also do our own spring work and things like that. We've I can't point the finger in too many places as far as component failures, that other than, say, that alternator bearing, where it's common amongst all the units in the fleet. If something happens to one unit, if it has a slack adjuster that malfunctions or whatever, that's about it. But I don't have anything really across the board that I could say that, this is absolutely the weak link on all the apparatus.
Isn't it, I've always found that it's a pay me now, pay me later kind of atmosphere where you can do the preventive maintenance and find the $100 bearing and address that, or you can wait until the $3,000 alternator goes down and now you have a major problem and the apparatus doesn't work and a major repair. Don't you find that to be true?
Yes. Everything that is done with the apparatus, whether it's a fire department that runs, a dozen calls a year or thousands, these vehicles are run under severe duty. In your own personal vehicle, you don't start it up in the morning and then floor it going out the door. And these vehicles are severe. I mean, whether it's suspension wear, a lot of times we don't get the chance to warm the engine up properly before we go to the call, it's severe duty. And everything that's connected to that, you have to look at it as, well, this needs more maintenance. I mean, again, if we were driving this apparatus, from here across the country in a straight line and going at 45 or 50 mile an hour, it'll be fine. But we're putting it through the type of duty that is very unusual for a vehicle. I mean, it's standard for the fire department, but let's just say for a vehicle of that size and weight. All these things that, like you're talking about, Mike, is being proactive. You have to be proactive on these things because there are so many things that can go wrong. And it's, the apparatus is only a year old. Why is this going? Or it's only 2 years old. That makes no difference. The age of the apparatus makes no difference. It still needs that certain amount of care because we are running at severe duty. I mean, find me an apparatus that is not running severe, and I'll show you one in a museum.
That's a good point, Captain. It was a lot of your observations are of things of what you've been able to do and accomplish down in Cherry Hill are things that would certainly be nice. We'd like Mike and I, together with everyone that counts on the safety and welfare of their lives and their families, to be incorporated on departments nationwide. So for our listeners, if you ever have the opportunity to find yourself in South Central New Jersey, cruising along the Jersey Turnpike and wanting to get out of that little drag race that they call if you're heading northbound or southbound, you get off around exits 3 or 4, you can find your way into the township of Cherry Hill and Captain Park's fine motor maintenance division and glean some more from what they've been able to accomplish over these many years. So, Captain, again, myself and Mike, we're very, very appreciative of your time today to share your thoughts and some of your experiences with our listeners. Michael, any other final thoughts here before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would like to thank Captain Parks as well for taking the time out of his busy day to join us, Tom, and continue to find work. You have really set the bar for a fleet your size for motor maintenance, and just have done an excellent job year in and year out with you and your staff, and it shows just by comments from the line troops. So just keep up the good work.
Well, I do appreciate that. It's, you know, it's a pleasure being with you guys, and just let me say that everything that we're able to do here is because I have the support of the chief's office and you know, the fire commissioners, and you know what, that's where it all starts, because you know, they may not, you know, understand the internal workings of apparatus and things like that, but they understand how important that they are, and you know, we have all the support from them that we need, and it's fantastic, and we're hopeful it's going to continue.
Well, again, Captain Parks, thank you very much for your time, and to wrap up this session, the apparatus architects, this is Mike Wilbur and Tom Chan. All our listeners out there, stay safe, and look forward to seeing you here again soon on the radio. Be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.